The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Do you want a beautiful lawn? Enter True Green, the easiest way to get a great lawn. Just water and mow and they'll do the rest. Weed control, fertilization, aeration, and more. True Green is the official lawn care treatment provider of the PGA Tour. And they have a verified best price, which guarantees you the lowest price with no compromise on quality. You do you. Let True Green do your lawn care. Visit TrueGreen.com, TrueGreen.com to get the best lawn at the best price with the best people. Guaranteed.
America, demand your MTV! I want my MTV!
I want my MTV!
I want my MTV!
Call your cable company and say I want my MTV!
Talk is Jericho, baby! Talk is Jericho!
Welcome to Talk is Jericho. It's the pot of thunder and rock and roll. And guess what? It's Friday. So here you go. The Duff McKagan joke of the week.
Hey, Chris Jericho, Duff McKagan here. I'm in New York City. You know, everything happens fast. There's New York Minute and all that. So last night I was playing my Wonderwall on my acoustic guitar all night long. My wife asked me if I could just stop playing Wonderwall on the acoustic guitar. I said, maybe. Thank you very much. Bye.
That's for you 90s Oasis fans there. If you get that one, it's because you know Wonderwall from the Oasis album. Definitely maybe. Maybe it's going to drive you crazy. I don't know. Definitely a Duff McKagan original. No maybe about that. I think he probably made that up on the spot. But they can't all be winners. But thanks to Rock and Roll Hall of Famer Duff McKagan for sending in his joke of the week every single Friday, no matter where he is in the world. And I'm sure he'll keep sending them in even when Guns N' Roses hits the road again in November. They're going to the Philippines, Jakarta, Taiwan, Hong Kong, Abu Dhabi. They are going everywhere, man. Guns N' Roses making a worldwide presence known. They're also coming up on this show, at least in conversation, in topic, with today's guest, original MTV VJ Mark Goodman. One of the original five VJs who introduced MTV to the world in 1981 in August, pretty much 37 years ago. It's hard to believe. But Mark remembers some of the videos GNR did for MTV back when MTV still played music videos. Mark is also talking all about the launch of MTV. It debuted August 1st, 1981. Wow, like I said, 37 years ago. You'll discover where and how they got the videos that started the channel. There wasn't a lot of rock videos back then. How Mark got the job and what it was like in those early days of MTV. He remembers his auditions, his first day on the air, and the reason why he and Alan Hunter still fight about being the first MTV VJ to this day. Who was the actual first? We'll find out. Mark's also talked about some of his favorite interviews from his days there, like the time he sat down with Paul McCartney, his first conversation with Madonna, hanging out in partying with David Lee Roth and Van Halen. He's also talking about the interviews he did not get to do, like the time Martha Quinn got to talk to Bob Dylan instead of him. He's still mad about that. So original MTV VJ turned Sirius XM radio host Mark Goodman coming up. Also coming up, the next leg of Fozzy's Judas Rising tour in the United States. We're starting up again tomorrow with Adelita's Way, Stone Broken and The Stir. That's tomorrow in Birmingham. Tonight, sold out in Atlanta, Friday night, August 24th. We are sold out tonight. Birmingham tomorrow, Saturday. Sunday, Huntsville, Alabama, Sidetracks Music Hall. And then we go to Clarksville, Tennessee at O'Connor's on the 29th. Springfield, Illinois at the Bank of Springfield Center on August 30th, my wife's birthday. And August 31st in Little Rock, Arkansas at the Revolution Music Room. Don't forget about September 1st in Aftershock in Merriam, Kansas. That's Kansas City. And then, of course, Taste of Madison on October 2nd. A lot more dates after that. We're going all the way to September 29th in Fort Lauderdale. Go to FozzyRock.com for all information, all tickets for that, and all tickets for the Australian, New Zealand tour, November 7th in Auckland, November 9th in Melbourne, November 10th in Sydney, 13th is Adelaide, 14th is Brisbane, and then we're hooking up with 3 days grace for a few dates on their Canadian tour. Moncton on the 21st, Halifax, Quebec City, Montreal on the 25th of November. Go to FozzyRock.com for all ticket information and also how to buy tickets for one of Fozzy's legendary VIP meet and greets. One of the best in the business. We play a mini concert for you. Then we take pictures, we sign stuff, we hang out with you, answer your questions. Do it now. It's something you're not going to get with any other band. Go to FozzyRock.com for all VIP information, all ticket information, and stay right here, Talk is Jericho, to hear Mark Goodman with all the details and stories about the birth of MTV, starting right now, right here on Talk is Jericho.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
See, that's a true radio pro, making sure your phone is off. You can tell that you've been in the biz for a while, kid. And talking about being in the biz, we're here at Mark Goodman's house. And we met when I did some press for the Fozzy record.
Right.
When you were at your show on Sirius, Debatable.
Yeah.
And the first thing I said to you was, I saw you on Saturday Night Live.
Dude, you blew my mind that you remembered that.
Well, you know,
that was like the worst season of Saturday Night Live. It was one of the worst casts. Rich Hall was the guy who did me.
Yeah.
Oh my God, I just was blown away.
Well, it was so funny because, you know, when you do a press tour, you go around to place, and I didn't even really focus in this. Like, hey, we're going to debate all this. I was like, that's Mark Goodman, dude. That's one of the original MTV VJs and the guy who was on Saturday Night Live. And that's what made you, like, to me, it was like, if you can make it on Saturday Night Live, that's a big deal.
I felt the same way. I was blown away that
did you know that you're going to be on that?
No,
week?
But I knew Rich before that, when Rich was just doing stand up and he was, you know, like doing teeny clubs. I was a DJ in Philly and we did shows with him all the time. So I knew him. I spent a lot of time with him, you know, just hanging out and having cocktails, you know. So to see him, one, he got the gig, and then him doing me on there was
crazy. Because he had the big, like, curly wig.
But you know what? I was a lot better dresser than he was. You know, he wore this, like, shitty, like, army jacket or something, you know, and I was just like, I don't dress like that, man. I dress, like, nice. I have vests and shit.
That made you part of the cultural zeitgeist, though. And just by proxy of being, once again, one of the original five VJs on MTV, which people still talk about to this day.
Yeah.
You know, there was you. I'm like, what's the other? There was
Let's
Alan
see if
Hunter.
We can do it. Okay, Come on. Five of us.
Now remember, I'm from Canada, so I never had MTV.
I know, much music. Yeah.
So I could tell you Erica M. And actually, you know, it's funny. There's a guy who's called J.D. Roberts. And he was one of the original Much Music VJs. He's now a reporter on CNN, John Roberts.
John Roberts was on Much Music?
Yes, J.D. Roberts.
Oh, wow. I had no idea.
He used to do the metal show, the Power Hour. So, okay. So it's Mark Goodman, Alan Hunter, Martha Quinn.
Everybody knows
I remember
Martha.
Who's the blonde girl? There's a blonde girl, too.
Nina. Blackwood.
Nina Blackwood.
Yeah.
And
J.J. Jackson.
J.J. Jackson. There you go. Yeah. Wow. So
the late great.
Oh, when he passed away?
He died almost 12 years ago now.
Okay.
Yeah.
So we're talking, though, about this and kind of, you mentioned you were a DJ in Philly.
Yeah.
Videos at the time were basically promotional clips because you see them from time to time. There's a few Beatles, there's some Kiss, you know, I Was Made for Loving You type things.
Yeah.
But where were those videos shown at that time?
Well, the odd thing, before MTV, before I had even heard about MTV, when I was still working in radio in Philly, I was at the number one rock station in the city, and I was about to host a video music show on UHF. We all remember UHF.
UHF, yeah, yeah.
So I was going to do on Friday nights an hour-long video music show that would be simulcast by my station. Mm-hmm. Then they made me music director, and I was already doing, you know, an air shift 6 days a week plus music director, and I stopped doing that. That was 79. 1980, I moved to New York, and I was working at PLJ, at the number one station in New York, and hating it. Mm-hmm. Just because we weren't playing anything cool that I really wanted to play. And I got the call about MTV. Like, a friend of mine from Philly called and said, we know this guy, he's a producer, and they're doing this thing with this 24-hour video music channel. And I had seen them as a music director in Philly when record companies would bring in, if like Duran Duran in particular is one I remember, that they brought Planet Earth, you know, videos from Planet Earth, Girls on Film in particular. And that's what they used them for in Britain. Was they used them for Top of the Pops. A lot of times bands that couldn't make a performance, they would have a video, and that's what they would show. And that's why in the beginning of MTV, you know, we had like three videos. We just rotated over and over. And so, because, and most of them were British.
Interesting.
Because Brits were doing it.
Because I remember, like you said, you wouldn't see them. I remember Solid Gold, that show in the States, would show a clip from time to time. You know, and you would see it here and there, but like you mentioned, it was never anything really concrete of, as far as this network. And even cable television as a whole, was there wasn't a lot of cable stations.
No.
Right? Well, at
that
time?
Was, I think, you know, our luck at MTV was amazing because we came at a time when it was right for cable to start to blow up. And MTV wound up selling cable. That's half the reason that it became so popular with the cable operators, because suddenly everybody, it was a phenomenon, everybody wanted to see it, so that was the way to get them to sign up.
So when you, was it based out of New York then, the original MTV?
Yeah.
Okay, so when you get the call, do you have to go do an audition? I mean, what's the kind of the process for that?
You know, I was just walking up the street with my daughter the other day, she's visiting, and we passed what was at the time the Sheraton Hotel at like 55th and 7th. Yeah, it's not your primo New York hotel. It wasn't a total flea bag, but that was where I had to go to meet this producer. And it was like, I was like, this is like a Harvey Weinstein situation going on, right? It was like kind of creepy, you know, like, yeah, come to 435 and you knock on the door. Right. And like there's some guy sitting on the bed, you know, like this is my meeting. But yeah, that was my first entree. And then I did two auditions. The first one, there was, I understand, about 1,000, 1,500 people, something like that, that they auditioned in New York, L.A., Chicago. I think they were in New Orleans also. And so they had a bunch of people that they were seeing in each of those cities. So the first one was just me on a stool in a studio that was like 12 degrees, you know, and it was like an interrogation, just like a spotlight on my face and a camera. And I knew that I had to do some music news and just talk about music.
Who was the guy that kind of created, who was this producer that you talked about that created MTV?
Well, it was a guy that I knew from, he didn't create it, but this was my first entree. It was a guy named Richard Bensavenga,
okay,
who
gotcha.
I think is, I don't know, I think he's still doing television, but he was with us just for the first few months of MTV, but he was with the company at the beginning before we launched. And he was a producer on TV in Philadelphia. So a friend of mine was also friends with him, and we had done stuff in Philly, he and I, and so that was sort of just a roundabout way that I heard about this, you know, 24-hour video music.
And of course, you're probably thinking, like, God, how long is this going to last? Who's going to watch videos?
Well, that's definitely the assessment. It's like,
get your little buddy, your little dog's on my lap now.
That's Oliver the pug, who
Hi,
is
Oliver.
Oh my God, look at him, he climbed up on your lap.
He's my co-host for the show.
I love that. But you know, the idea of
24-hour video,
it's to me, it was like, okay, you know, I had seen video, so I thought, yeah, all right, I mean, I think it'll be around. Seems like a good idea. And I was working at the number one rock station in the number one market in the country. If you're in radio, that's where you're headed.
Yeah.
You know? So for me to say, I'm going to quit, you know, it was ABC, an ABC affiliate. I mean, it was a big station and a big career thing for me. I left Philly to come here to do it. But I was hating it. So, yeah, I mean, I did that first audition. I got called back, like, 3 or 4 weeks later, was, you know, nail biting for 4 weeks. And the second one was a little bit more intense. They had this guy, Robert Morton, who went on to be David Letterman's producer, and he was friends with Letterman and Morty. You know, he would mention Morty in the early days of the show. And as it turned out, half of our production staff, makeup, and some of our floor managers and a couple of directors were all Letterman people, had worked with him on his morning show. We launched August 1st and like
August 1st, 1981.
81. And he launched like, I don't know, a couple of months later because they all left. Everybody left to go back to Letterman.
Right.
But yeah, you know, I lucked out. I got this call and I did the second audition, which was tougher, with Morton, who part of the audition was him pretending to be Billy Joel. but a really asshole version of Billy Joel. So like I'm trying to interview him and he's giving me a hard time and one word answers and he's like staring around the room and, you know, to push me. And so I did the interview, and the second part of the interview was I had to stand by an easel that had like cut out pictures of the band The Eagles, say something about The Eagles, and then walk over to a couch and sit down and throw to the video. I can do that.
Yeah, that's pretty easy stuff, right?
I can do that. So I did that, and apparently I did it better than a lot of other people.
The other 1,500 people. Yeah. But you mentioned something real interesting. Is like, and it's like kind of the chicken and the egg thing. Did MTV spur the rise of the video revolution, or did the video revolution spur the rise of MTV? Because you mentioned when you started, there was not a lot of videos in the system.
There definitely, we had very, very few. We literally had like a few hundred videos that we were rotating in the beginning. And
like, which ones do you remember playing a lot of at
the time? Well, the weird ones were like Andrew Gold. We played a lot of Rod
Lonely
Stewart.
Boy?
We played Lonely Boy. We played another one that, and I was an Andrew Gold fan. Lonely Boy is the one everybody knows, right?
You said a lot of Rod Stewart.
A lot of Rod Stewart we had, and like weird, like we had a band called The Producers early on with Amy Mann.
Wasn't
Till
there
Tuesday.
An early Pat Benatar one? I remember reading her book, and she said because she was one of the few videos that became really big.
Well, she was, this is, you know, the great trivia question. Everybody knows what the first video was on MTV.
It's just that video killed the radio star.
There you go. Okay.
Was it the Buggles?
It was the Buggles. Right. Jeff Downs and Trevor Horn, who would later go on to be Yes.
I didn't know basically. That. And Jeff Downs also from Asia.
And Asia too, right.
There you go. Okay.
But the second video, Pat Benatar.
Really?
You Better Run.
No kidding.
And so Neil, her husband and guitar player and producer, is very big on saying that he played the first guitar ever on MTV. Which is true.
There you go.
Buggles,
right?
No guitars in the Buggles. And
yeah.
You Better Run was the second video.
Huh.
So
when you only have a few choices and stuff, at first, what's the reception of the whole network? Is the country excited? Is it a hard sell?
Advertising-wise, it took them a while to figure it out. Mm-hmm. You know, advertising-wise, we on the air and, you know, sort of the lower downs in the company, we didn't really know, but we were dying for advertising in the beginning. And that was, you know, the first big sell was to sell the concept to the original company, which was Warner and American Express. Warner Amex was the company that owned MTV and founded MTV to begin with. And Bob Pittman, who was the head of the company, had, you know, the incredible schmooze and the ability to sell this to guys at American Express and guys at Warner in suits, who there was never anything like it. So to explain, it was tough, but he did it. Mm-hmm. So we get on the air, but then it's advertising.
Right.
You know, and it took, you know, better than a year before we were at least sort of breathing easy. Mm-hmm. But we used to get letters, or like in the first 6 months, we would get letters from people in, you know, like Arkansas, and they would talk about how that video that you guys show where, you know, there's the guy floating out in space and there's the rocket. And this was stock NASA footage that we stuck into 20 past the hour because that was what was called the local avail, where locals, cable companies could sell advertising to make some money. Nobody had anything. So we were showing that for like 3 minutes and people are writing us going, that's such a cool video. I love that. You know?
Right.
But that was the
just
big sell.
Just killing time, right? You just, had nothing to put in there.
We had to put something in there as television. You know, we couldn't have black. Mm-hmm. So we put something like that in there. But very, very few ads we did in the first 6 months to a year. We did this. It was a real instrument, but it was like a toy, a syn drum. And it was like a little synthesized drum kit, like these rubber pads. There was like four of them and like, dee, boo, boo, you know. Yeah. And we'd have to futz around with them on the air. And I'm like,
what's your sponsor?
It was syn drums, they were called.
Yeah.
And that was the sponsor. And it was like us doing like live reads on the air. We had to mess around with the drums. It was really, it was they were a piece of shit. It was kind of embarrassing, you know. Yeah. And from you know, that was my first run in with Pittman, because I was like, you know, me and JJ were the radio people. We had been working in radio. Martha Quinn was still living in the dorms at NYU. Alan Hunter was a cabaret guy. He was working as a bartender.
Nina
was kind of a musician. She was playing, you know, a harp in an airport bar in LA. A rocker, newer stuff,
yeah,
but was not working in the business. JJ and I were actually working in radio. And so I, you know, this syndrome thing comes in. I'm like, I call Bob and said, Bob, you know, we get paid for doing this. You know, it's an endorsement, you know, I'm putting my face with the product. And he's like, well, Mark, if you don't want to do it, I'm sure we can find somebody else who will. All right, Bob, I'm going to jump right on that for you. Yeah. You know.
Yeah.
That's how it went.
Hint, Bob. Yeah, for sure, right?
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Turn it on! Leave it on! America! See the music you want to see!
I want my MTV. All right.
I want my MTV.
I want my MTV. Ow!
24 hours a day on cable TV.
I want my MTV, MTV, MTV!
Yeah, too much is never enough.
So who are some of the bands that really kind of embraced this new way of getting their music out there? And was there any bands that were against it at first?
Mm-hmm.
Because there always is.
You know, it was a really weird new thing for bands to have to worry about, you know, how they looked and how they presented themselves and coming up with, you know, it's difficult enough to come up with a great song with great production. And, you know, now add this. Now you have to have a great video, too. And it was hard. And there were some bands who, you know, couldn't really cut it. And interestingly, bands like the Kinks, you know, oh, my God, you know, British Invasion band, they did great. They did really cool videos. Ray Davies was like natural showman.
You're thinking Come Dancing right off the
Come
bat.
Dancing,
what a great
of course,
video. That's
amazing,
classic,
right? So there were bands like that early on, but the harder rocking bands who were big for us had a semi-difficult time figuring it out. There was a lot of performance video, and the bands who really embraced it and did well with it early were the Brits. Duran Duran had been making videos already, so they were familiar. They started to work during the 80s. They started to work with people like Godley and Cream, who were these huge video producers. They used to be in 10cc in the 70s, and they turned into giant video producers. Spandau Ballet. I mean, the British, you know, the fluffy shirt bands, you know, Culture Club. Those guys, it was a normal thing to them because they grew up watching it on Top of the Pops. It really wasn't a part of our culture here. So those guys were the ones who really seemed in the beginning to feel the most comfortable with it.
I think that you obviously know that pops right into mind because you have the original videos, like you said, that were more story-driven. And then you get a guy like Michael Jackson who takes it to – or it's not story-driven, performance-driven. Then you take Michael Jackson who actually tells a little bit of a mini-movie throughout the course of his videos.
He upped the bar, and he was, you know, he was the guy who had the money to do it. That's the thing,
right?
You know, I mean, you know, if you want to spend the money, and he, you know, Thriller obviously was the big one in 83 that really turned things around in terms of video. And for him too. I mean, not that he wasn't a star beforehand, but
it made the difference. Yeah.
Yeah. Sure. I mean, he just, that was when he started calling himself the King of Pop.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he just went not next level. He went 10 next levels. You know, he really just exploded with that. And because he was one of these guys who could think beyond just the song and the album and the tour and could really think about creating something for himself, you know, an image for himself on video, really was all about it. Yeah.
What was the kind of the process to try and get a video on? Would there be like a record companies would send it to you and you guys have to decide yes or no?
Yeah. The five of us on the air had no say.
Of course, yeah.
You know, no say. JJ and I, and particularly me, just because I had an attitude when I started, because I had come from, I was programmer, you know, when I was in radio, I was a music director, and, you know, I was used to saying, this is what we're going to play this week. These are the new songs. So I was vocal about it. But yeah, generally there was vice presidents, like three of them in particular. Pittman was always involved, John Sykes, and Les Garland. These three suits would decide. And they were, you know, they were music guys. It wasn't like they had been working in music, but those were the guys who made the ultimate decisions.
Decision, right, yeah, right, right. Yeah. So would you get, like, when you started playing some of these videos, as they started to expand, and you're getting the Michael Jacksons, you're getting this sort of thing, is there a lot of kind of, you mentioned fans writing in, would that help you decide if you would play it? Obviously, like I said, you're just doing what they want you to do, but as far as going into rotation of playing it once a day, twice a day, was it the fans? Was it the quality of the video?
It was certainly the fans. You know, obviously no social media back then, so right. It was letters.
Yeah.
It wasn't even emails, it was letters. But they, all of the people that I mentioned, Les Garland came from records. He was at Atlantic Records. John Sykes was at Epic Records. Bob Pittman was in radio. He was the youngest. He was the youngest of everyone. They were calling him a wunderkind. He was programming WNBC here in New York, and he was like 24, I think, 25, something like that. So by the time he was at MTV, he was still under 30, but a radio guy. And they would follow the trades. They'd follow Billboard. They'd follow, you know, the real industry trades to see how things were moving. And back then, you could gauge things by record sales.
Mm-hmm. Sure, right. Yeah. I'm sure once the record companies started seeing the difference, because I'm sure if you had a hit video, your sales would go up. And then now everyone's trying to get these videos going. Yeah.
That was the thing that America really had never experienced. Mm-hmm. And we launched August 1st. And by the end of the year, we started to hear from these places in, like, Arkansas and Wyoming, these little towns, but towns that had cable. Mm-hmm. And there would be record shops there that, you know, the first Duran Duran record had been off the shelves for 2 years because it came to radio and nobody played it. Nobody in this country played it. But we started playing the video a lot. Mm. And people started going into the record stores all over the country and asking for this band, Duran Duran. And the record shops guys were going, who's this? You know, and that's the way that we started to realize, oh, I think this is going to work.
You became more influential in radio.
We did. I mean, we like to think that we did. Mm. I think as far as real studies are concerned, radio was always number one because, you know, it was in the car and it was sort of everywhere. And, you know, even today, radio is still the number one place that people discover music, even with YouTube, which is next.
It's true. Yeah. Rock radio.
Yeah.
Our song right now is done really well, but it's really made a difference for the band because you still think, oh, radio's dead. It's not dead. It's still very important.
Yeah.
And you wish that there was an outlet like MTV, but that's now been replaced by YouTube anyways.
Yeah.
But at the time in the 80s and 90s, to get on MTV was a huge deal.
Yeah. Yeah,
you know?
And people would see a bump. I mean, and you know, Pat Benatar did. She talked about it in her book, and a lot of these guys have talked about it in their books. That it was this weird thing for them to a band that was playing bars like Pat Benatar was. She was playing clubs of, you know, 200 people, 250 people, and all of a sudden MTV hit, and within a couple of months, suddenly they were playing 5,000 seat halls. They would come into town and people would be waiting at the airport for them. I mean, it was a whole new world because of
it. And it's interesting too, because you're talking about kind of that crossover from the 70s to the 80s. And obviously in the 70s, you had David Lee Roth and you had, you know, Kiss, but a lot of the bands, you're talking about, you know, maybe like it's Deep Purple or somebody like that. Not the most good looking of guys, but it didn't matter.
Yeah.
Suddenly now in the 80s, not only do you have to be a good band, like you said, you got to be good looking. So a band like Duran Duran, they're tailor made for it, and that helped them. But other bands probably got hurt because they weren't hot.
Well, the harder rock bands had to figure it out.
Yeah.
They had to figure it out, and they did. You know, they look at Scorpions.
I mean,
not a great looking band,
yeah,
but they had some rocking videos, and the video era for us in the States with them, they were huge. People went crazy for them.
That's a great call. I'm thinking Rock Like a Hurricane, where you don't have to be hot, but just put a bunch of hot chicks in it. In a cage.
In a cage, yeah.
Right?
Exactly. We loved Rudy and Klaus.
Yeah.
Rudy and Klaus, Meiner.
So when you now that record companies are behind it, I'm sure publicists and bands are getting into it. Did you do a lot of interviews with the bands that would come through town?
Yeah.
Tell us about some of those that you had.
Those, you know, that was what we were about, you mm-hmm. know. Certainly for JJ and I, we both were really up for talking to these guys. And it was because it was television for everybody, it was a new world. JJ and I hadn't really done TV, so I'm trying to think of something, you know, some of the earliest bands, you know, like we didn't get into you know, Headbangers Ball for years. Mm-hmm. Van Halen was big for us early on. Judas Priest was huge for us early on.
Really? Because once again, not a great looking
band. Not a great looking band. Yeah. But they, you know, they were Brits, so they had the commitment to video. Halford was always great on video. And they were huge for us in the early days. And, you know, kind of generally, there was, you know, the fluffy shirt contingent, but then it was metal. Mm-hmm. You know, it was hard rock and metal. That was the stuff that really worked for us. I'm trying to think of some of the other bands. I mean, I interviewed Dave early on, Van Halen early on. And then
obviously Dave's a great interview for sure, right?
Yeah, you pretty much ask one question and sit back.
Let him go, right? Would you have a guy like that? And like, would you be like, is this guy's too much? Or was it kind of fun? Or was it a little bit annoying?
I love Dave.
Yeah.
I love Dave. I spent a lot of time with him. I actually went on the road with him for a while.
No kidding.
Yeah.
With Van Halen? Or with Roth Solo?
With Solo. So right after he left.
What was the concept behind that?
We wound up getting friends at the US Festival, US 83.
Mm-hmm.
And that video, the video of that interview is on YouTube, and I encourage you to check it out. I've seen Dave, you know, hammered in a lot of situations, but never like that night.
Right.
And it's hysterical.
Yeah.
He's so funny. And so we really hit it off. We hung out a lot at the US Festival, and then I started to, you know, I was sort of involved with him as he was doing the record, the solo record. And, you know, he invited me to come out with him. So, you know, things were crazy for me in my home life. It was my first marriage. It was breaking up. I was having trouble. And I was like, I need to get away. And I went out on the road with David Lee Roth. Jesus. It was insane.
What's it like being out on the road with Roth in 1986?
You know, you can imagine whatever you imagine. It is absolutely that. I mean, it was the things that you heard about Van Halen, like from the stage, they would have, you know, those sort of sawhorses to hold the crowd back, but they were color-coded with like red, blue, green, yellow. And Eddie Anderson, who was Dave's assistant, but was with Dave when he was in Van Halen, you know, Eddie would be by the side of the stage, and Dave, during the course of the set, he would run over and he would go, okay, red, right, four rows back, green, left, seven rows back, and Eddie would go out and slap passes on these girls to bring them backstage.
That's
and
so great.
That's what it was like.
Yeah, exactly.
These girls were there by their own. They wanted to be there.
Yeah, exactly. You mentioned something quickly about the US Festival, and that's one of my favorite gigs, and just the whole concept of that, how big it was. And
it was crazy.
What was it like, you know, behind the stage with all the bands that were there?
I was there in 83, which was the second year that they did it, and I couldn't believe Wozniak did it another year, because he got just taken to the cleaners the first year, made horrible losses. Same thing with the second year, but it was an even better lineup the second year. I mean, they sort of divided it up. You know, there was Metal Day, so Ozzy was there, and
Scorps
and Van Halen. And Van Halen in particular got tons of press because they got paid, supposedly they got paid $1 million, and they spent it all on their compound. And it was this immense thing backstage with trailers and, you know, all kinds of, you know, bars, and it was lights. I mean, it was nuts. It was what you would hope that they would do, right? And so I was like, you know, during the interview, one of the things I said to Dave was like, so how do you, you know, what is it? How do people get in here? And he was like, oh, no, it's really easy to get in, but it's much more difficult to get out.
Yeah, classic, right?
So, but he, you know, they knew how to do it, and mm-hmm. it was their backyard, so they felt like it was a hometown gig for them. But, you know, the craziness of Us 83 was Bill Graham. Bill Graham was the promoter, and Bill Graham is notorious for not taking shit from anybody. And the Kinks were there, that, and he wanted his shows to run like clockwork. If you were on stage at 2, then you were on stage at 2. No bullshit. And he literally, the Kinks were having some sort of problem. I don't even know exactly what the problem was, but they were, it looked like they were going to be late. And Bill got the manager's car on a forklift and raised it up and was like out over this like man-made lake. And he was like, are they going on? Are they going on? It was like, and Bill, that's real. Bill did that shit.
Yeah, it's a great saying.
It was nuts.
Rock and roll, like, especially with those promoters, it's like, I'm not sure what time you're going on, but I know exactly what time you're going off.
Oh, right.
Bingo, right?
For sure. And the Clash were there that year also, and they pulled the ultimate. I mean, they held this press conference, and they were, you know, pulling all this corporate, you know, not non-corporate, you know, sort of punk attitude. Bill Graham was just not in the mood for that. And they were an hour late, and he was going ballistic. I remember seeing him run around backstage, and it was the Clash were just drawing all this heat and all this press. And U2 was also there, and I was talking to Bono backstage about it, and I remember the line that he came up with. He was dissing them heavily. I mean, now he speaks so highly of them. Yeah. But he was like, yeah, Mark, we're here. We just want to play for everyone. We're not here to hide behind our haircuts. That was his line. You know?
Bono said that about the Clash?
Yeah.
Nice. But you mentioned that too, because there was a lot of, like, I always think about the heavy metal day, but the other day was, there was like a new wave day, and yeah, there was like a pop day or something.
Yeah,
like that.
I guess. I mean, I'm just trying to think of all the bands that, like, Bowie was there. Bowie was the headliner on his day. I think Van Halen was the headliner on Metal
Day.
They were, absolutely. I remember them going on at night. Yeah. I mean, Ozzy was on. That was another weird thing that happened at the US Festival, was that for the first time, MTV was going to do live hits from this event. Mm. We had never done that before. And so one of the live hits was supposed to be me on stage on Metal Day, which was the heaviest attended. It was 500,000 people there. And it
That's
was like
insane.
In San Bernardino, it was like 105, and it was just, and they were hosing people down in the front. And so I come up on stage to bring Ozzy out, and it's still light out. It was still hot. It was like 4 p.m. And you know how it is when you're going to bring somebody on stage. You got to rev up the crowd and do your thing. And hey, I'm Mark Goodman from MTV. So great to be here. We're rocking. You guys are all live on MTV right now. Hey, all right, let's bring out Ozzy. And I'm looking off, and they're like, they're waving like, no, not yet. Wait. I'm like, what? Wait, what? We were too early for the satellite, for the live hit. That was supposed to happen live on MTV.
Oh, no.
And we were too early. They cued me too early. And so 500,000 people, I got to go out and go, all right, great rehearsal.
Take two.
Exactly. It
was like, showbiz though, right? Yeah.
So embarrassing.
And talking about the technology at that point in time, like you said, on the satellite and stuff. I mean, it's pretty scary to think that it even works at all.
It was, you know, the satellite hits, that one was a little rough, but we did more throughout the weekend, and they worked a little better. But it was a big thing, and a big thing for us because, I mean, really, you know, we were a brand new channel. You know, we were only on for a couple of years, and that kind of, you know, technology was sort of trying to keep up with us, you know. Mm-hmm. Even in terms of just the way our videos were played, that progressed so much over the first couple of years. When we first launched, the night we launched, we had tech problems because the people at the uplink out on Long Island, where everything went up to the satellite and then was broadcast down to all of the cable outlets, they didn't have machines to segue between songs. It was like a cassette with one song would be in, and then like a director would have to switch, you know,
manually,
like to bring up the next song. You know, it wasn't like a
wow.
It wasn't automated.
So it'd be video by video. Someone would actually be there for an 8-hour shift.
Yeah, they called it residue directing. So it was like they would have our segments that we would record in the studio, and they would have another rack with like all of the imaging, and another rack with the videos. And so on the night of our launch, the rocket was supposed to go up. John Lack, who was the CEO of the company, said, ladies and gentlemen, rock and roll. And then it was Video Killed the Radio Star. Then it was You Better Run. And it was me. It was supposed to be me. And it was me going, hi, I'm Mark Goodman, and you're about to experience this new thing. You'll never look at music the same way again, blah, blah, blah. What wound up happening was that happened, those two videos, and then, and I'm Alan Hunter. Because the guy put in the wrong cart. He played the wrong thing, completely out of order. I was supposed to introduce, you know, all of the VJs. Right. It was my show. I was the first VJ on MTV for the first 5 hours. It was me. But that those first 5 minutes were completely fucked up.
So you had the first shift, but they never, you know, Alan Hunter was the first face.
And that's been a fight between us for 35 years because he claims to be the first VJ. I'm like, no, dude. Just because of that fuck up. I was the first VJ. My show was first, but he's like, it's like in his Twitter handle, Alan Hunter, first VJ. You know?
No, causing heat. Well, I guess, you know, technically he was the first, though. You saw his face first.
Oh, so you're taking up with him?
Yeah. In your house?
Get the fuck out.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Comes, I mean, is a Michael Jackson ever coming to MTV to get interviewed?
He didn't come in.
Yeah.
But yeah, he was interviewed. I never got the chance to interview him, although I did meet him at an event and talk with him briefly.
Mm-hmm.
But God, that level of star,
sure.
It was rare. I mean, Robert Plant came in a couple of times.
Mm-hmm.
I interviewed him once, JJ, who knew them really, really well. JJ Jackson was the guy who played Led Zeppelin on the radio in the United States for the first time. He was the guy. In Boston, who played them. So they knew him really well, yeah. But most people did come in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they did come in.
Who were some of your other favorite interviews that you had?
Madonna.
Oh, wow,
You know, Madonna. I was a huge fan of Madonna right off the bat with the first record. And
once again, completely embraced the whole video concept.
She was made for it.
Yeah.
She that was the thing, that she knew it. Maybe nobody around her knew. You know, we didn't know, but she knew. She just knew. It was just so comfortable for her. And I talked to her after the first album came out.
Mm-hmm.
And we talked at that time about Like a Virgin. She was really excited about this new album that was coming out, and it wasn't out yet. And I remember talking to her about her belt buckle, which said boy toy. So I'm like, what does that mean, boy toy? And she goes, what do you think it means? And I, you know, I was like much younger and much less experienced. I went, well, I don't know. God, you know, she owned me in that interview. Oh, man.
Just a total pro, even at that age.
She was so confident. She was totally confident.
Wow. And it's funny, too, when you think about that at the time. My co-host is having a little conversation. Just the, like, I remember the controversy of Like a Virgin, like, such a controversial title. Like now it's like, are you kidding me? But
it's goofy. And that, and those guys, years later, I became friends with them, Billy Steinberg and Tom Kelly, who wrote a bunch of great songs in the 80s. Eternal Flame for the Bangles and I'll Stand By You for the Pretenders and just awesome songs. But what Madonna liked about it was that dorkiness about it, you know? And Billy Steinberg, the guy who came up with the original concept, was like, didn't even think of it as controversial. For him, it was like he'd come out of a horrible relationship and he'd fallen in love again.
Mm-hmm,
and so it was like a new thing for him. He
like
was all
virgin,
like, I feel like a virgin. I feel brand new, you know? And it's very different when a guy sings it.
Right.
And Madonna loved the idea that a guy had written it, but she was going to sing it.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good point, right? When you're talking about how kind of the network starts to progress, and you're mentioning that now you have a little bit more technology. And were you there when the whole like dial MTV thing?
Yeah.
Because that was huge. Like that's when I, even as a Canadian dude, you would hear about, oh my gosh, you know, Bon Jovi was 10 weeks number one at dial MTV. Like
Motley Crue.
Yeah.
Motley Crue were unstoppable. Unstoppable. I know that all of their fans had speed dial and they were just calling us like crazy. Dial MTV was a big thing for us. That was really us like starting to just dip our toe into really getting direct contact with the viewers. Like that, the fact
it's
that you
like
could
an
do
early
something
version of social media, the instant.
It really was. It was exactly that. It was exactly that, and it became a huge show right away. Right away, that people could directly influence it. And by the time, and it was, I don't know, I want to say maybe 3 years in that we started doing that, and it really, MTV was already a phenomenon. So to be able to have that kind of influence, you know, for somebody watching in Nebraska was such
became
a huge
thing. Yeah, especially for you, like the metal bands, the rock and roll bands. There's a lot of them.
That was always for the Dial show. That was they were always ruled.
Yeah, that was the ones, right? Yeah. When you talked about Motley Crue, when guys came to the studio, did you ever any guys come in that were just totally out of their minds?
Yeah, no, I interviewed them the first time that they were in, and I at that time I did not get it. Mm-hmm. You know, they were. I was just like, what, these guys are idiots. You know, like it just like the whole the glam metal thing, it was like with some people I dug it. Not that Judas Priest wasn't glam by any means, but there was, you know, they started to, maybe it was a video thing, they started to be more aware of what they were wearing, you know, a lot more leather and studs, I guess. And it felt with Motley, they were great. They did what they did, but I just thought it's just so, it's not anything really great. Years later, I actually sat down and did a long interview with Nikki Sixx and realized how smart this guy is. And how, I didn't realize at the time how much he was the brains behind that band and the stuff that he, the songs that he brought, how great they were. Mm-hmm. It took me years really to figure it out. And now, props to those guys.
But like
big
you said,
time.
Some of those guys are deceptively smart or deceptively stupid, whichever one it is. Like Nikki doesn't want you to know how smart he is. I think the whole Motley Crue machine was guided by him.
Yeah, I didn't know. And they didn't really make that clear at the time. You know, I mean, it was everybody focused on Vince. And, you know, he was the lead singer, and although they all were hot, and they all had this sort of, you know, LA rock thing attached to them. Vince, you know, wasn't known that Vince was really the guy.
But you would always assume that, like, even like he just passed away, Malcolm Young.
Yeah.
Over the years, to find out that Malcolm was the real brains behind AC/DC. Yeah, but you thought it's Angus Young, but no, it's Malcolm. It's all Malcolm.
And that, you know, you mentioned that, and that was, man, that was so sad.
Yeah.
Malcolm. And what was, I think, really cool was that so many great people came out and said he was the guy.
Yeah.
I mean, Angus always idolized Malcolm, right? But like to hear all, you know, Scotty Ian and all these really cool people just come out and say, man, nobody like Malcolm. Nobody.
What bands did you see over the years that you knew would kind of be shifting the cultural, like for example, like obviously you have the Beatles and the Stones, and then you kind of get into, you know, the Van Halens of the world, and then you kind of go to the Guns N' Roses and those, like, or Metallica's. Was there bands, did you know right away when you saw some of these bands, like, oh, that's going to be a game changer?
Yeah, I had some that I picked and others that just,
like, which ones did you pick that you knew?
Trying to think of the one, like the ones who were newer. Duran Duran, I was a music director when the album came out in 79 80. Didn't play it, but then I saw the videos like everybody else, and I went, "Man, these, look at this guy, this lead singer, man, he's really cute. The girls are gonna love him. They're doing these sexy videos." So Duran Duran right away. Madonna, obviously same thing with MTV. I couldn't have guessed that it was gonna be a cultural phenomenon. I didn't know Madonna was gonna be what she became, but I knew that she was gonna be something. She was so dynamic and the songs were so cool and she was just exuding all this heat, you know. I'm trying to think of who else. I mean, there was a band, I talk about them on the air these days, a band called the Monroes, who I love. Nobody, you know, they're
I don't even know them.
They had one song. They were a really cool band. I think I want to say they were out of San Diego, and they had a song called "What Do All the People Know," and we played it on MTV. But they signed with a Japanese label that folded a month after their album came out. So, and they tried to sign with an American label, they disappeared. So, but we still play them on Big 80s on Sirius, and I get to talk about them.
But that's what it takes, though. Like, you know, especially at that time frame, where a DJ could make a difference.
Well, the interesting thing, I mean, with MTV, we didn't, like I said, we didn't really have say in the programming. We didn't decide what got added or how often it got played. But this thing happened where we became stars. You know, we became
the five of us. Sure.
But at weird stars, because we weren't the stars. We weren't the rock stars, but we weren't the people either. We were sort of right in between. So we were like the conduit to people to, like, through us, they could get to them. Mm-hmm. And so that if we, you know, would talk about stuff on the air, which we certainly, we could talk about whatever we wanted. So that if we supported an artist, people turned on to it and people listened to us. So we had some influence, I like to think.
How was it? How long was it until they brought in another VJ? Was it the five of you for a long time?
Yeah. And when Julie Brown was actually the first
downtown Julie Brown,
who we love.
Yeah,
we just did 80s in the Sand with her in Punta Cana, Dominican Republic, just a couple of weeks ago.
Been there, yeah.
And you've been there,
yeah.
So I mean, it was great fun. And Julie came in, and she was just doing VJ shifts in the beginning. She didn't start to do Club MTV until I had left. I was gone a couple of years by then when she started to do that. But, you know, I can't think of anything comparable in another business where, you know, it was the five of us, and it was an unusual situation because it was like, you know, I characterize it as like the five of us went through like Vietnam together. Mm. You know, we went through something that nobody else could understand. We suddenly were at the center of the universe, this thing, MTV made us stars, and everybody knew us. And so it was just a weird phenomenon. So we bonded in that way. And we're all, to this day, we still all talk every week. And, you know, this girl, this British chick shows up out of nowhere. You know, she doesn't know what's going on. She doesn't know anything about us or this channel or anything. She just got the gig. So it was difficult for her.
To break into your club, especially
because, you know, she had two girls who were used to being, you know,
the girls.
They were the girls. Yeah. And now here's Julie Brown. She's cute. She's got an accent. She's all bubbly and, you know,
a little catty, a little bit.
You know, and they'll admit it.
It's funny though because it's almost like you guys were in a band at this point. You five guys brought together, and now you probably have ups and downs. And this guy's being an asshole today. And
well. It's in the book. You got to read the book, VJ. We were all really honest in the book, but we, you know, we talk about the fact. In fact, the book starts with Martha, and something that one of the cool things about the book was that we all found out stuff about the others that were like,
that you didn't
what? When did that happen? We had no idea. Mm-hmm. And so Martha, I remembered vaguely. Martha got a gig to do. Dylan. Bob Dylan. Martha Quinn, 21, knew jack about music, and she got that interview. I was pissed. Mm. And we kind of had a little thing about it. You know, we had a little fight about it. Mm-hmm. I was like, why is this girl who doesn't really know who Dylan is and couldn't name three Dylan songs if you paid her,
right.
Why does she get that interview? Why not me or JJ? So that kind of stuff happened, and it really, over the course of things, you know, the politics of the five of us, everybody had their moment in the sun when they were like, their stock was higher than the others, that the company guys liked that one more. We would all want, you know, certain interviews. You know, everybody wanted to interview Robert Plant, you know,
right,
when he came
course,
in,
yeah.
But only one of us gets to do it, you know, and that kind of stuff happened.
I can see that for sure.
It happened, you know, yeah. What are you going to do?
You know, I've often said, I've seen this a couple times, like if you go to like a One Direction, for example, and they sell a shirt, an individual shirt of each guy at the merch stand. I'm like, that's the worst thing you could do, because one guy is going to be the top and one guy is going to be at the bottom, right. And everyone's going to know it. You know what I mean? And that's kind of the same thing. Like
Niall's like, nobody's buying my shirts.
And that's what I'm talking about for this type of thing. Like, I can see that. Like why the hell is Dylan for her? And then it makes you mad, and then you get pissed off, and then she gets mad. Well, I don't think I can do it. That would cause some issues.
I learned in the book, not only did she get to do this interview, and I found out years later why, but not only did she get to do this interview, but something happened where, well, she, like, it starts off with her like doing his makeup. He was wearing eye makeup at the time and stuff.
Yeah, that's right.
And he asked her to, can you help me out with this and touch up my makeup? And because it's a girl, you know, I mean, it's like girls have a leg up in that situation.
Right,
but,
sure.
And then something happened where they were in London. She went to London to do it. And something, oh, he invited her to come with them to Ireland. To a gig that they had in Ireland, and they got, she went, she literally, it was like she did the interview, he invited her, she had to run back to her hotel in London, get her shit, and get on the plane with them, and then they were on the bus in Ireland, and they had a bus accident, and so he sends Martha back with his son, Jesse, to the hotel to make sure that he's okay, and that was why she got the interview, because Jesse had a crush on Martha. So Dylan pimping for his kid.
There's certain things you just can't do, man.
Hey.
Was there any other interviews that you didn't get that you wish you would have?
There was one that I got. Like I got back at Martha. I got McCartney.
Ooh, that's a good one.
I got McCartney, and she was disappointed. Let's put it that way. She's a huge Beatles fan, sure. And she was really disappointed. And it was a similar situation. I got to go to London to interview him and went to, you know, Air Studios, where he was recording Give My Regards to Broad Street, the soundtrack for that horrible movie. So I got that, and she was disappointed.
How was the interview with Paul?
One of the most amazing experiences of my life. It was supposed to be like me and a crew flying over to London to talk to Paul for 15 minutes.
Right.
That's what we were supposed to have, 15 minutes. So I'm sitting.
Which you would do in a second, fly to London for 15 minutes.
We were there.
I'm in.
That's all we expected was 15 minutes. Yeah. That's what we were going to get. And so we sit down and we're talking. And of course, in 15 minutes, I'm looking like directly at Paul. And behind him is his publicist running back and forth, giving me the cut sign. And I said in the middle of the interview, and this wound up staying in it, I said, Paul, they're telling us that we have to wrap now. And he leans forward and he smiles at me and he goes, let's not. And I was like, Paul likes talking to me. I was so jazzed, man. It was like exciting. And we talked for another 45 minutes about all kinds of stuff. And we wrapped the interview. I had never been to London before. He asked me if I had ever been. And I said, no, I was there with my wife at the time. And, he says, oh, well, you have to go to a couple of places. Let me recommend this restaurant. And he throws out the name of this one restaurant. And then he goes, oh, no, you don't want to go there. That's kind of pricey. And I'm thinking, McCartney thinks it's pricey? No way do I want to go there. It's like the richest guy in rock and roll. But he literally called up this other place and spoke to the manager there, who he knew and, of course, knew him, and said, my friend Mark is coming down. I want you to give him... Paul McCartney made me a dinner reservation. Never forget
it. That's cool stuff, man.
It doesn't get any cooler than that.
What you mentioned that you had left at a sport. What made you decide to move on or from MTV?
You know, it started to get to a point where MTV had just hired Kurt Loder, and towards late 86, it started to get to the point where the executives were looking more towards print for credibility. It's one of my big gripes with them that they didn't stand behind us.
I mean, journalists that were like writers would.
Yeah, Kurt Loder was a Rolling Stone writer.
Oh, I see.
And they hired him to do news. Now, Kurt Loder was a guy who I had never met him, but I knew his work. I had read him in Rolling Stone a bunch, and he definitely knows his shit to this day, and he knew it then, he knows it today. But he would make a hard left turn in a freaking album review to slam MTV and to, you know, say what a lame, you know, idea this was, and how we never really did anything worthwhile, and slam the five of us. But damn if they didn't, you know, come around to him, and he was like, yes, I will sell out for that. You know, absolutely. You know, so they hired him, and I understand, but I also understood that meant that the things that I had been doing, the great interviews, the location things, I wasn't going to get those anymore. Mm. So it was at that point that Alan and I both quit on the same day. Mm-hmm. Nina and Martha and JJ didn't have their contracts renewed at various times. But the two of us were there. We had stayed, and but it just got to a point where I thought, all I'm going to be doing is just recording these VJ segments in the studio. No. And at the same time, I had been bitten with the acting bug. I got requests from a couple of different directors to do stuff, which I did. And I just had the best time doing it. So I wanted to just give it a shot, just to study.
Expand your
see what it was like. Yeah. Stuff, yeah. So I quit and did a deal with MTV where July of 87, I moved to L.A. And for the next year, I came back for 1 week a month, and I did shows for a week a month. And then for the following year, I did interviews for them, and I would host like press events to announce the VMAs and stuff like that. So I worked at MTV for most of the 80s. And, like, by the end of 89, I was pretty much gone.
What do you think of MTV now and how it's morphed to nothing to do with music in a lot of ways, or most ways?
Well, MTV made the decision early on to not grow old with their audience, to stay with the same basically 12 to 25 year old audience. That was their core, and that was what they decided to do, which was fine. To this day, I get tons of emails every day at the big 80s, man, bring back the old MTV and bring back those days, and MTV should be playing music. There's no need for MTV to play music now. There's no need. YouTube. Why would anybody bother?
Right.
Although they're trying to figure it out. They brought back TRL. Now they're bringing back Jersey Shore. I mean, the fact that they're bringing back TRL is a huge, huge thing. I would not want to run that place now. Where does a video music TV channel fit today? I don't know.
It's funny, too, because just talking about how, like, in this day and age, is there a lot of people that still see you and go, Mark Goodman? Like, it's like you said, you came from this magical, very cultural change, and you were one of the faces of it. People still, like, if you went to a comic convention, you could probably sign autographs for hours, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it depends. I can walk down the street in New York without much problem, but at a concert, it's another thing. You know, people, you know, in the right environment, people certainly know. And I... You know, you remember me from back then, so you know I look a lot different.
Curly hair.
The Jufro is gone. So people, what happens to me often is that I'll be, you know, at a store or something, and I'm paying for something at the counter, and I'll talk to the person behind the register, and somebody standing behind me will recognize my voice. That's where I get it.
Very recognizable.
Which is awesome, you know? Yeah. You got to love that. I mean, it's right when people recognize you. It's flattering, right?
Yeah, it is.
It's, like, it's cool.
Especially
to talk to people.
When you realize you influence somebody's life, whether whatever it is, when they were a kid, a teenager, now. Yeah. It's like, man, I used to watch you when I was a kid, or I watch you now. It's like you've been around that long where people have grown up with Mark Goodman. That's a pretty cool thing, right?
Do they say that to you?
Yeah.
And I grew up with you.
I'm like, how old are you? Like 22? Like, geez, man. I watched you when I was a kid. Well, aren't you a kid now?
Right, exactly.
How old are you? You know? So you still obviously in the business, done so many things, and now with Debatable, do you enjoy kind of going back and doing radio now? This is where you started?
You know, I've been at Sirius for 14 years. It's actually the longest job I've ever had.
Wow, yeah.
And I was on three channels before. I was on 80s, Classic Rewind, and a channel called The Spectrum, which was current music. So it was current, like current, what we called adult rock, you know, for people who are grown-ups but still like rock and roll. But now I'm just doing 80s and Volume, and it's live. That's the thing for me. That's the way I started. When I started in radio, I was live, obviously, and freeform. I played what I wanted, and that's kind of like what this is. You know, the Debatable is, and the channel, a talk channel about music. Who's doing that? You know, so I feel really lucky that, you know, as it happens, the guy who runs the channel used to work at VH1. I know his brother, who is the guy who is credited with doing all of the MTV Unplugs, a guy named Alex Coletti. So I feel really lucky that I get a chance to do this talk channel. I get to talk about music, which is all I would be doing anyway. And, you know, have people like you come in, and it's great. It's awesome. I feel really lucky. The fact that it's live, and the fact that, you know, when I do interviews for the 80s, I got to do, like, 2 minutes, 2.5, 3 minutes, and then play a song. I mean, there's no chance to have a conversation.
Yeah, so, exactly.
It's awesome. I'm happy.
Last couple questions. What are some of your favorite videos from those days?
From back in the day?
Yeah.
I was always a huge fan of Peter Gabriel. Mm-hmm. He, I think, always had a sense of doing something different. That it's a weird line to walk where the video supports the song, but isn't louder than the song, if that makes any sense. You know, sometimes the video can be so distracting in whatever way that it sort of takes, almost distracts you from the song.
Whenever I hear "We're Not Going to Take It to This Day," I always think the video more than the song.
Right.
Always. Yeah. That's right. A good point.
So he, like, Big Time was an amazing
Sledgehammer
video. Sledgehammer, legendary. Mm-hmm. And he was a guy who, he really embraced it. He was one of those guys we were talking about earlier who really embraced video and just saw it as another way for him to express himself.
Yeah.
The Duran Duran ones I still look back on and love because they're so that moment, you know, that they just, like a great song, takes you back to a moment. Mm-hmm. And the same thing happens with those videos. I think Ray Davies, he was always a fun guy to watch. You know, he was into being on camera.
Mm-hmm. He got it. Yeah.
Even, you know, Dave did some funny stuff. You know,
he was great with his videos.
He was great. I mean,
Van Halen, the 1984 videos leading to solo stuff. Yeah.
I mean, Hot for Teacher.
Classic.
It's one of the greatest videos of all time. I mean, it just doesn't get any better than that.
I went through a little phase. It was his birthday about a month or two ago, and I watched all the Roth videos, starting the Panama Hot for Teacher, leading to California Girls, and just the whole thing. Just how ridiculous and goofy can we get with that campy Roth style? That's one of the winners of the 80s video sweepstakes for sure.
And it was him and Pete Angelus, who was wound up managing him solo, and he was the lighting director for Van Halen.
Okay.
But Pete was in... was it Hot for Teacher? Pete directed Hot for Teacher.
Yeah, he's in the beginning of I think it's California Girls. You know,
where they have those guys looking into the camera and like they're on the beach and
then he comes in with the give me a glazed donut and a bottle of anything to go.
To go.
Whatever one that was. I think it was maybe Yankee Rose. I think that one.
Yeah, Yankee. Well, that was Dave.
Yeah.
In that get
up. Sure, but I think Pete Angelus was the manager with the big pomp.
Exactly.
Story,
and
he's
exactly.
In the story. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Finally, who's your favorite bands?
These days?
Or of all time, whenever. Yeah.
I love, these days, I listen to Dawes. I love Dawes a lot. I listen to a lot of dance stuff. Mm-hmm. I love beats. So I like a lot of DJ stuff. You know, I like Cascade and... one of my favorite, most favorite bands, Fozzy. Love Fozzy.
Thank you. Nice plug.
In all sincerity, I was never a heavy metal guy. Mm. I always like hard rock, you know, like Priest.
Yeah.
But like Lemmy, it took me a while. Again, like almost with, maybe was it sort of like what happened with Vince Neil and with Motley Crue and Nikki Sixx, that it took me a while until I was older to get it.
To get Motorhead.
Yeah,
I agree.
I don't know why.
I agree. I'm the same.
It's usually the other way around. I would think, like, when you're younger, you get that stuff more.
Mm-hmm.
But
it took me a while to figure out they're just an old-time rock and roll band with Lemmy as the vocal. They're basically
really
playing ramped up versions of Chuck Berry songs.
And once
you get that, it's like, that's a great band.
Exactly.
Yeah.
AC/DC,
mm-hmm.
You know? But I mean, the stuff that I listen to these days, I'm always about, and this is probably a bad thing, I guess, but I'm always about what's new, what's going to be happening in 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
That's why it was always difficult for me after MTV, you know, that would, radio jobs that people wanted me to do were at 80s stations, which is fine. I mean, I like the 80s just fine, but I was around in the 60s and 70s, you know, so it's not like the 80s.
Right.
For most everybody who knows me, it's like the music of their adolescence. That's what most people tune into. That's the most important moment musically in their lives. That's when music was great. That's when people were really making, well, hey, it's somebody's adolescence today, you know, and they're making great stuff. Yeah. I like the XX, a band called the XX. That's all I can think of right offhand. A lot of DJ stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I go to EDC and hang out there and watch these guys.
You're hip, man. You're still hip.
Hey, I'm willing to stay up all night. I got a date with my daughter. We're going to EDC in Vegas this year for sure.
That's the way to do it. Stay young, man. Like I said, you don't even look half your age. So that's good stuff. Dude, great time, man. Thank you so much.
Chris, I can't thank you enough for inviting me to do this.
This is awesome. Your first podcast.
My first podcast.
Did you enjoy it?
It's awesome.
Yeah, see?
I could do this.
You could do this. Hello. Hello, Mark. There you go. I think you got a career ahead of you, kid. Send me a tape and a resume, and I'll see what I can
do. Right. All right.
All right. Thanks to Mark Goodman. You can hear him daily on the SiriusXM 80s channel, 80s on 8. He also hosts Debatable from 4 p.m. to 7 p.m. Eastern on SiriusXM's Volume channel. That's how we met. I was a guest with Rich Ward on Debatable. Mark was a great host, a great guest as well. Check out Mark Goodman on SiriusXM, the man with the curly hair. And check out Chris Jericho's Rockin' Wrestling Rager at Sea at ChrisJerichoCruise.com. Book your cabin now and come hang with me. And this is a great lineup of talent. We set sail October 27th to the 31st, Miami to the Bahamas. We are getting closer to a sellout. I know I say that every week, but we really are. I'm really pleasantly surprised at how cabins keep on selling. We're going all the way, but you got to book soon. Remember, when you book your cabin, everything, all the activities included in the booking price, including food. You'll get access to all the live podcasts, stand-up comedy shows, meet and greets, concerts. The only thing you pay for when you book a cabin is alcohol and gambling. And here's what you're going to see, the big main event, Alpha Club versus the Bullet Club, the Bucks of Jericho, or is it Y2 Jackson versus Kenny Omega, Cody and Marty Scurll. Don't forget about Impact versus Ring of Honor, Sammy Callahan versus Marty Scurll, LAX versus the Young Bucks, and now we have Brian Cage, Johnny Impact, and LAX challenging the Bullet Club to a match on the cruise, the ultimate Ring of Honor versus Impact match. Will that match happen? Wait and see. Don't forget about Live Talk, Talk is Jericho with Ricky the Dragon Steamboat. Another one with Eddie Guerrero Rememberies with Conan and Rey Mysterio Jr. Another one with the entire Bullet Club. Another one with Jim Ross and Jerry Lawler, the greatest commentators in WWE history. Then we got Mick Foley doing his 20 Years of Hell stand-up show, talking all about the Hell in the Cell show that took place 20 years ago. We got Killing the Town versus Keeping It 100, Conan versus Don Callis, Disco Inferno versus Cyrus. And don't forget about the first round of the Sea of Honor tournament that's been announced. Lethal versus Whitmer, Daniels versus Delirious, Skrull versus Titus, Silas versus Flip Gordon, the second bracket, Mark Briscoe versus Ferrara, Paige versus Kazarian, Cheeseburger versus Beer City Bruiser, Jay Briscoe versus King, and live music from Fozzy, Corey Taylor of Slipknot and Stone Sour, Phil Campbell and the Bastard Sons, King, The Stir, The Dave Spivak Project, The Darlings of Rock and Roll, The Cherry Bombs, Shoot to Thrill, the world's greatest AC/DC cover band, female, Blizzard of Ozzy, so much more. Beyond the Darkness will be there scaring your pants off. Colt Cabana and Marty DeRosa doing their hilarious unprofessional wrestling show. Busted Open Radio is going to be there. Live comedy from Brad Williams, Craig Gass, Ron Funches, the Impractical Jokers. Don't forget the special hosts, Jim Ross and Jerry the King Lawler. Don't forget about James Ellsworth. He's going to be defending his intergender championship there. Cruise director SoCal Val. Special guest host Noelle Foley. We got Mandy Leon is going to be there. The Women of Honor, Kelly Klein. We've got Brandi Rhodes. Another fine Woman of Honor to be announced very soon this week. So much going on. Go to ChrisJerichoCruise.com. Come join the fun. Book your cabin and be a part of history. All right. And coming up on Wednesday, speaking of being a part of history, as I go to my schedule and find out who is it going to be, because I forgot. Ah, the mysterious, the strange, the crazy Bon Scott, one of the greatest lead singers of all time and one of the craziest partiers of all time. We go in depth into the wild life and mysterious death of Bon Scott. If you're an AC/DC fan, if you're a rock and roll fan, you're not going to want to miss this one. I'm telling you right now, it's going to be bone-chilling and very, very cool rock and roll, man. It's a long way to the top if you want to rock and roll. Bon Scott knew all about that. So we'll see you on Wednesday. In the meantime and in between time, stay hard, stay hungry, and a big peace, love, and hugs, and a big yeah, boy. Have a great weekend. Aye.